everybody. This is Andrew with New York City Indie Media. We're going to kick off. We're starting a little late. It's 9:15, and this is Global News Break. Firefly might be up later. I'm not certain with the local calendar, but we're going to be going from the Global News Break to the IMC Roundtable discussion, talking about advertising and indie media. Then at about 10:30, we're going to go to Humorous Tears. Jesse will be playing on the tuba with percussionist Fritz Welch. Then at 11:15, we'll probably have a music interlude, which may have a phone in with Brad. And who's he talking with? Who's Brad talking with? Oh, and people from the Moore Gardens Coalition. There was recently a really big action, and he'll be talking with them about that. And then at 11:30, we're going to go to our Chomsky Media Critique with Tom, and that's the lineup. So let me start up tonight with the Global News Break. This is basically a hodgepodge journey of things that I found on the wire, all kinds of places. Believe it or not, I wish I could get on the Wall Street Journal website, but you can't without giving all your information away, which I don't want to do. You have to subscribe, too. That's right. But apparently there's a very good article, believe it or not, because sometimes they're not reactionary over there. They're just stupidly conservative. But there's an article about how that guy, you know, that guy that got detained or that they just revealed on Monday in the Midwest that, do you know what I'm talking about? That guy the FBI found. Well, also today, the Bush administration just signed a $4.3 billion bioterrorism bill, which is going to appoint all kinds of monies to protect our waters and all this kind of jazz. And if you ask me, there's a big connection because they only revealed this guy was detained. He's been detained for like a month.
The guy just got detained, and it happened to coincide with 2 days after Mueller's, the FBI director, Robert Mueller's testimony in Congress, as well as the testimony of, what was that woman's, the whistleblower's name? Does anybody know? McCauley? Her testimony. So it clearly was like an offensive move by the, at least in my opinion, by the administration to sort of deflect attention from their shoddy protection, right? And what's come out further is that they're not even going to prosecute this guy, right?
So they're saying they're not. That isn't their aim right now. They just want to find out as much as they can. This is like a sort of a paraphrase in a Rumsfeld quote, which is, you know, they're sort of peppering a scene for like the legitimacy of torture, if you ask me. But in terms of that, they're not even interested in whether or not he did it or not. They just want to find out what he knows. Which apparently may not be anything, since the whole thing sounds very, very flaky. And this is something that you don't see much in the American media. I'm really sick of doing this, like, oh, the corporate media sucks. Because I think it kind of neglects the fact that these are all, like, weird institutions, and you have these weird elements that happen, like you have a Fisk over at The Independent. If you ever read The Independent or look at it as a whole, there's a whole lot of crap in there. And then you have this weird Fisk guy writing his stuff. I mean, Independent is hardly independent. It's mostly corporate commercial garbage. So I just think we should think about the cracks that happen in this like weird modern times that we live in, and that you can find, in fact, in some weird places like the Wall Street Journal, the most critical analysis of this, which, in fact, they were flaming about how there's almost virtually no evidence to bring this guy in for. You don't see that on ABC News, and I'm not hearing that in The Voice, frankly. Let's see. What news we got? Oh, there might be a big strike, which will affect, I'm sure you've all heard, about just-in-time delivery, which is part of the whole globalization and privatization ideology going on. And the real effects of it in terms of the just-in-time delivery is going to be possibly very severely disrupted by what may be a massive walkout strike later in the summer by the Longshore and Warehouse Union Pacific Maritime Association, which is the big union out in the West Coast for longshoremen and container ships, dealing with container ships and all that. Last time they struck was 1971, and apparently there's tremendous pressure, as you can imagine, not to strike. This is like a major significant aspect of how the economy rolls. But apparently right now the negotiations, because this contract right now is going to end, I think, in early July, there's big negotiations right now that apparently, according to I'm reading this from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer reporter, are different. And this difference is generating fear among retailers and shippers. they're pushing the there's a big conflict in terms of the Maritime Association is pushing for technological upgrades at the ports, while the union is looking to make pension changes and protect traditional longshoremen jobs from going to outsiders. Now, of course, I'm quoting here from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer reporter, and as you can tell, some of the word choices here are a little funny. So what this is looking like is that there is a they're expecting that there's going to be at the least let me start over on that sentence here. There is currently a media blackout on the whole thing because the negotiations are really pretty heavy right now. There is belief that there is going to be a slowdown around the 6th of July. Which looks like at that point the people that I just mentioned, the Maritime Association is probably going to lock them out. Bush has the possibility of doing what's called a cooling off period, which some people believe he may very well bring into action, given that we're in this economic recovery thing and any disruption would be negative, according to this senior economist. The Hershey strike, you probably heard about that. Well, that's over, and apparently it's left with some fairly bitter feelings, as you can probably imagine, between the two parties. It's being termed a face-saving deal in the end, and no one's real happy. The company wanted to raise healthcare premiums to 12%, and which was down from their demand of 18%. Meanwhile, union members said they were striking as a bulwark against corporate greed. They lashed out at Lenny, who's the president, I believe, of Hershey, and who's seen as an outsider, whose $4.6 million salary and bonuses last year exemplified a profitable company that, in fact, scrimped on worker benefits to afford huge corporate perks. Texas is going to court against Arthur Anderson. They're attempting to revoke the operating license, accusing the firm of violating rules in its dealings with the class energy trader Enron. This could have implications for other states. The board announced that it was seeking at least $1 million in fines from the firm. Anderson makes no secret of having shredded papers, but claims that it was a normal procedure, not an attempt to cover up fraud. Without the need to prove criminal liability, the board has argued that any destruction runs counter to the standards it expects from accounting firms. And if they win that point, that has tremendous significance. The board is seeking $1,000 from the firm for every perceived violation from accounting rules. A list that it says could well number into the thousands. Anderson, meanwhile, is keen to avoid corporate-level responsibility for the Enron collapse and has aimed to shift blame onto his Houston office, and especially the former Enron lead auditor, David Duncan. In Germany, there's big concerns about what may be a very big overall set of strikes that will occur throughout the country by all kinds of unions. Right now, the Postal Service and Deutsche Telekom are staged for brief stoppages. Construction workers are thinking about it. They need 75% backing to do a strike that's scheduled for the 17th of June. And people are expecting that this will be a summer of slowdowns. This comes at a time where Schroeder and the economy there is not as fantastic as they thought it would be. Schroeder, being the chancellor there, has an election in September, so there's pressures along in different ways going on there. It should be really interesting. We'll see what happens in the summer. Currently ending tomorrow, there is the World Food Summit, which notably not any from the wealthier industrial countries of the North did any of the major leadership did go to. The efforts there are, of course, to reduce world hunger and a few other things. You can find out about it through Agence France Press, an article there. Let's see. Oh, ecotourism. Ecotourism is actually putting a lot of wildlife in danger, according to a scientific report right now. Scientists in Chobe National Park, Botswana, have documented how tuberculosis was passed on to mongooses in the reserve, leading to two outbreaks of the disease. Ecotourism is one of the fastest expanding areas of tourism, growing at between 10 and 30% annually. The United Nations has designated 2002 as the International Year of Ecotourism. People have, in fact, been warned in the Antarctic not to go too close to penguins incubating eggs, which are on such a tight energy budget that any unnecessary rise in heart rate could force them to abandon the egg to look for food to survive, leaving the embryo to die. Basically, there's potential for the tourists to introduce and spread exotic diseases. If it ever did occur, the effect would be catastrophic. Ecotourism is a huge source of revenue for wildlife conservation, particularly in Africa. But Dr. Alexander and others think contact between animals and humans should be minimized, obviously, to reduce the threat of infection. The interesting aspect of that story is that it's on the rise, and we're seeing more diseases getting put, you know, that animals are now getting from this. And so it's a bit of a contradiction. I just wanted to spell that out a little bit for you. In New Jersey, just came out today on AP Wire, June 12th, today, the federal government can, in fact, keep the names of post-September 11 detainees held in New Jersey secret. This is a real major defeat, I think. A state appeals court said Wednesday in a ruling that the head of the Immigration Naturalization Service has broad powers to prevent release of the information. The ruling was a setback to immigration and civil rights advocates who have been seeking the naming of names of detainees held in New Jersey County Jail since last fall in an attempt to monitor their treatment and ensure that they have adequate legal representation. The U.S. Justice Department argues that releasing the detainees' names could help terrorist organizations, blah, blah, blah. According to the most recent Justice Department figures, 104 detainees remain in custody nationwide, the majority in New Jersey County jails. The three-judge panel ruled that INS Commissioner James Ziegler had the right to administer immigration matters and that some detainees might not want their names to be made public. The panel ruled that releasing the information could jeopardize the safety of the detainees or their families and might also hurt criminal investigation. Mm-hmm. According to the New York chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, it's very inconsistent with other decisions concerning government secrecy since September 11th, which have courageously recognized that open government is essential to the success of democracy. The recent detainee who was supposedly going to be doing some dirty bombs is, although in the United States we're getting you know, as I mentioned earlier, we're getting really virtually no concern or questions about this. This is not the case in Europe. In fact, British security forces there, the British high end of the like CIA there, has a great deal of doubt, according to this article in the Independent, and you can check it out for yourself. There's some interesting stuff there. Meanwhile, and I told you about this, $4.6 billion bioterrorism legislation has been signed by President Bush on Wednesday, today, June 12th. That is going to be devoted to stockpiling vaccines, improving food inspections, and boosting security for water systems, calling it his, quote, urgent duty to prevent germ warfare. It's coincidental how this all came together. The bioterrorism bill would spend $640 million to produce and stockpile smallpox vaccines for vast numbers of Americans should terrorists reintroduce the eradicated disease. The bill would also pump more money into the national pharmaceutical stockpile, secret stashes of medicine at locations throughout the United States. It would provide $1.6 billion in grants to states for hospital preparedness and assessments of the vulnerability of local water systems. Daschle said, we have a lot of questions to ask about how it works and whether or not the proposal from the White House, when it comes, is the right approach. But we'll work with them to see if we can find the right approach and reach a consensus on it. Even some prominent members of Bush's own party were raising concerns about the plan. House Majority Leader Dick Armey of Texas said many lawmakers are concerned the president's plan does not envision the full participation of the FBI and CIA. Under Bush's plan, intelligence would be analyzed by the new department, the House Security thing, which would have no authority over what the agencies actually did. Many of us feel we can maybe, perhaps more completely, do that job that was outlined by the president. We may have to pull these agencies more fully into the structure than was recommended. I don't know what that's all about. During the Reagan period, this was also published in... I think this is in Common Dreams, which is a really good website you should check out. And it came from the AP on June 9th, which is it became revealed that the feds had worked to quash college protests during Reagan's political career. The FBI working covertly with the CIA and then Governor Ronald Reagan spent years unlawfully trying to quash the voices and careers of students and faculty deemed subversive at the University of California, the San Francisco Chronicle reported. For years, the FBI denied engaging in such activities at the university, but a 17-year legal challenge brought by a Chronicle reporter under the Freedom of Information Act forced the agency to release more than 200,000 pages of confidential records covering the 1940s to the 1970s. These documents describe the sweeping nature of the FBI's activities and show they range far beyond the campus and into state politics as the agency plotted to end the career of UC President Clark Kerr while aiding Reagan's political career. In his in its unsuccessful battle to keep them secret, the agency had said its actions had been proper. They had merely tried to protect civil order, blah, blah, blah. Things are done a lot differently today, said the FBI spokesman. The files speak for themselves. The documents obtained by the Chronicle show just how extensive these activities were in California, and how eagerly Reagan worked to quash protests. Governor Reagan intended to mount a psychological warfare campaign against subversives, file tax evasion and other charges against them, and do anything else it could to restore moral order. Reagan's legal affairs secretary told the FBI in a request for confidential information about people on campus. The records show FBI Director Hoover agreed to provide such information from the agency's files. And we're trying to turn mic off, and we're, hold on a moment. And I'm back. Sorry about that. I just had a technical difficulty there, a little bit of a glitch. Where was I? Reagan was elected California's governor in 1966 after repeatedly called insulting with the FBI while campaigning against campus malcontents and filthy speech advocates at Berkeley. One of his first moves was to fire Kerr, who never received another White House appointment. Kerr's own FOIA request was denied by the FBI, said he was unaware of the plots against him. Maybe I was too naive, but I never assumed they were taking efforts to get rid of me, he told the Chronicle. Little did he know. Hey, listen, they spent a lot of money recently on the, you know, FBI and these guys, and I'm sure they've got to do something with their time. So what would you do if you were, like, into spying on people, you know, for a living? I think you'd keep records and all that crap. It's just sort of a system. Let's see. UN official is seeking scrutiny of anti-terrorism measures. The United Nations, the highest-ranking UN human rights official, is calling for an independent expert or a new international body to monitor the impact of anti-terrorism measures on human rights worldwide. Mary Robinson, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and former President of Ireland, said, my office is flooded with calls from human rights defenders around the world drawing attention to new restrictions and oppressive measures. Robinson, who is leaving her job in September this year, said several governments, which she declined to name, have instituted repressive measures in the name of fighting terrorism. It is essential that actions taken by members stated to combat terrorism be in conformity with international human rights standards, she said. Robinson said she regretted there is no international institution to assess whether measures taken by member states to combat terrorism violate human rights standards that these states have accepted. She said a new counterterrorism created by the UN Security Council late last year, does not believe it has a mandate to monitor these issues. The great concern now is that where mature democracies blur the lines or set a bad example, undemocratic regimes consider they are given a green light to pursue repressive policies. Several nations, particularly the U.S., Britain, Germany, and Canada, along with countries such as Egypt, Russia, and Uzbekistan, have introduced far-reaching anti-terrorism measures, some of which analysts, activists, and officials here have deemed in violation of basic human rights. Yeah. This is Andrew, New York City Indie Media, doing the global news break thing. And I think that we're kind of running towards the end here. There's more to go, but I feel like I'm talking a million miles an hour here, and I'm not certain that anything's coming through. We'll be back in a few. New York City Indie Media. This is Andrew back again with New York City Indie Media, and I hope I'm not clipping here. And just to end with some kind of good news, so to speak, on the Global News Break, which is that a genome discovery that is supposedly going to revolutionize cancer treatment was discovered on the 10th of June, that scientists have identified the genetic faults responsible for most lethal skin cancer in a groundbreaking study that could revolutionize the investigation of all kinds of tumors. Mutations in a gene during the life of a patient cause normal skin cells to turn malignant, according to researchers attempting to screen the entire human genome for cancer genes. The findings relating to the skin cancer gene are described as so clear-cut that already the scientists are designing specific drugs to bring about a cure. The scientists working at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute in Cambridge said the mutated gene called BRAF is found in 70% of malignant melanomas, the most lethal form of skin cancer, and 10% of colon cancers. Unlike many previous cancer gene discoveries which have identified inherited predispositions to cancer, this latest study explains how the genetic material of a healthy cell becomes corrupted and turns into a tumor. Said Professor Mike Stratton said the work showed how a mutation can cause a healthy cell to divide uncontrollably by flicking on its growth switch permanently. The most exciting thing about this discovery is that it could be a direct lead to new treatments for malignant melanomas. Because mutated BRAF is permanently stuck in the on position, we have already started searching for drugs that will switch it back off. The findings published yesterday in the online edition of Nature resulted from a systematic sweep of the first 300 of the 30,000 or so genes decoded as part of the Human Genome Project. And this is Andrew here at New York City Indie Media. We'll be